Hello there. Today is Tuesday, August 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the Attorney General vows to continue the investigation into an accused sex trafficking millionaire who killed himself in prison.
Any co-conspirators should not rest easy. The victims deserve justice, and they will get it.
The Trump administration issues its biggest change yet to the legal U.S. immigration system. Also ahead, the administration takes a hatchet to the Endangered Species Act. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. Attorney General William Barr Monday criticized the federal prison where Jeffrey Epstein died in an apparent suicide, adding that the sex trafficking investigation involving the disgraced financier will continue. Speaking at a police conference in New Orleans, Barr said there will be accountability over the cause of Epstein's death.
We are now learning of serious irregularities at this facility that are deeply concerning and demand a thorough investigation.
Epstein was found dead Saturday, having apparently hanged himself in his cell at the Metropolitan Correctional Center in Lower Manhattan. The 66-year-old was arrested on July 6th and pleaded not guilty to federal charges of sex trafficking involving dozens of underage girls as young as 14. Barr is the top U.S. law enforcement official, and he vowed to carry on the case against anyone who was complicit with Epstein. Joining us now to talk more about the case, criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Thank you for being with us. So how could this happen in such a high-profile detainee? How could he manage to be left alone long enough to take his own life?
This is a systemic breakdown. There is an approach in place and how you would address issues like these, specifically those who are on suicide watch, and specifically somebody who had already tried it previously. As a result, it was a multiple failures that actually caused this, that allowed for something like this to take place. And so to call it isolated doesn't do it justice. To call it a bad apple doesn't do it justice. This is a systemic failure.
Why wasn't this person under suicide watch if he had already tried once?
When you really look at this, this highlights one fundamental point, a lack of resources at the federal level, honestly, at the state levels as well. Problem that we're seeing in our federal and state prisons across the country is increasing costs, increasing expenses, and decreasing funding. And as a result, they're trying to make do with less. The problem is they're under more stress, they have more people to deal with, and they don't have the resources to do it. And so they stretch themselves, they try to make it work, and when they don't make it work, they try to find one person to blame or two people to blame instead of looking at the system overall and saying, this is broken, we have to fix it.
Why do you think the Attorney General is so angered by this? Do you think that he's concerned that maybe the Justice Department will be faulted for not doing a better job of overseeing this?
It makes justice and the federal penal system look incompetent. And to some degree, it is. I mean, that's the problem here. That is the failure. This should not have taken place. This should not have happened. There is a series of systems in place to make sure that somebody who is a defendant awaiting trial is protected from others and also protected from themselves. And when there is so much evidence before them that makes it clear that they have to do certain things and then either choose not to, are incapable of doing it, or don't care. Either way, there's a failure from the top down and in pretty much every single direction.
Why is it such a big deal when someone like this that hasn't stood trial yet and there are so many victims coming forward, why is this such a big deal? And what does this mean for all those victims who wanted and needed to be able to face this person they're accusing of doing these horrendous things to?
It's horrific because the whole concept of our criminal justice system is that justice will be done and that those who are victimized can stand up, voice what happened to them. Not that they're going to be made whole, because that's not how it works, but at least confront those who committed crimes against them or allegedly committed crimes against them, and to stand up and say, I too was a victim here. Problem is now is what he has done. He's stolen that. He's stolen the ability of apparently many people to stand up and say, dare I say it, me too. Think of this like all of those young gymnasts who had been victimized by that one doctor. Mm-hmm. And their ability and need and desire to come forward and say, you did this to me, is something that allows them to move forward, to move on, not to get rid of it, not necessarily ever going to happen, but at least to acknowledge what it means and what he did to them. These yeah. people will never get that chance.
What happens when potential accomplices of this man are discovered or they're talking that this case will go on? How can justice be served if the main culprit has committed suicide?
This is going to be much more complicated for the feds now. What we find is the Attorney General is arguing that co-conspirators should not rest. The problem with that is there is a lot of evidence out there that may have died with him. And as a result, they may very well rest a little more soundly than they might have otherwise. And that's the truth. I've represented people who are co-defendants in cases involving sex trafficking. And what I can tell you is that if they disappear, if they die, if something happens to them, that can be a major piece of the puzzle that the state has to put together that they no longer have. And so there are those times when co-defendants, even minor players, can simply walk as a result. And that may be one of the ramifications of this suicide.
All right, criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, thanks for your perspective. Well, in an effort that appears aimed at reducing legal immigration in the U.S., the Trump administration announced a new policy that would impede immigrants already in the country from obtaining permanent residency or citizenship if they use public benefits such as Medicaid, food stamps, or housing assistance. VOA's Patsy Wittakuswara reports.
Arturo Balbino entered the U.S. illegally 14 years ago. He has an American wife and children and a letter from his construction company employer guaranteeing him a job. Yet in March, his green card application was denied. The reason? His family's use of food stamps and Medicaid, assistance programs for low-income households.
A veces quiero pensar que todo va a salir bien.
I want to think that everything will be okay and I'll be able to be with my family again. It's very difficult to think that I won't be able to return to watch my children grow up.
There will be more people like Balbino, immigrants denied legal status because they are deemed to be a burden to taxpayers, based on a new policy announced Monday.
President Trump's administration is reinforcing the ideals of self-sufficiency and personal responsibility, ensuring that immigrants are able to support themselves and become successful here in America. Our rule generally prevents aliens who are likely to become a public charge from coming to the United States or remaining here and getting a green card.
A public charge is defined as an individual who receives one or more designated public benefits, such as medical or housing assistance, for more than 12 months within any 36-month period. Immigration activists accuse the administration of unfairly targeting poor immigrants. The rule won't take effect until mid-October, but the impact is already felt by immigrant communities.
This public charge rule has deterred some individuals from trying to access public benefits just because they're worried about either being detected by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, for instance, for immigration enforcement actions, or being targeted by this public charge rule.
President Trump is running for re-election in 2020, and his tough stance on immigration may win him support.
With his base, this is something that, you know, I think is very much a win for him and something that he may be touting in the future, especially if Democrats continue talking about expanding public benefits for illegal immigrants.
The rule does not affect humanitarian-based immigration programs for refugees and asylum seekers and contains exemption for victims of human trafficking and domestic violence. The rule also does not impact family-based immigration, as citizens who sponsor family members for a green card already have to produce an affidavit of support showing that they can provide financial assistance. Patsy Wittakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Well, the Trump administration took steps Monday to significantly weaken the U.S. Endangered Species Act, prompting state attorneys general and conservation groups to threaten legal action to protect at-risk species. The 1970s-era act is credited with bringing back from the brink the extinction species of such as bald eagles, gray whales, and grizzly bears. But the law has long been a source of frustration for drilling and mining companies and other industries because new listings can put vast areas of land off limits to development. The weakening of the Act's protections It's one of many moves by U.S. President Donald Trump to roll back existing regulations to hasten oil, gas, and coal production, as well as ranching and logging on federal lands. Joining us to talk more about this is Noah Greenwald, Endangered Species Director with the Center for Biological Diversity. Thanks for being with us. So what exactly did these reversals do?
A whole slew of things that really undermine protections for endangered species. So there are three rules, and the first of which applies to listing of species as threatened or endangered and designation of critical habitats for them. And under that rule, it allows, maybe even requires, Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries Service to consider the economic impacts of listing a species as threatened or endangered. And this is something that Congress had specifically precluded. They had said these decisions about the very survival of species should be limited just to the science. You know, is the species at risk of extinction or not, without consideration of economic factors? And now those economic factors will be considered, which is really unfortunate. And then for critical habitat, the rule makes it a lot less likely that species will get designated critical habitat. And specifically, they say that if a species isn't threatened by direct habitat destruction, then they won't designate critical habitat. So, for example, species threatened by climate change, they wouldn't designate critical habitat, even though those species clearly need it. It also makes it harder to designate critical habitat in areas where species currently aren't found, which again is really bad for species threatened by climate change, because you may need to, you know, for example, if you're a species that live at the beach, you know, you may need protection of habitat inland, factoring in the fact that you're a species that's going to need to move.
So basically what you're saying is that going forward, the Endangered Species Act will not provide the same protections that it has for many of our threatened species. Is that what you're saying?
Very much so. Some of the other things it does, it changes how critical habitat for species that are listed will be protected by defining what qualifies as adverse modification of critical habitat. And it limits that only to projects that threaten the entirety of a species' critical habitat. So you can picture, you know, a species that's got a pretty wide distribution but is still very threatened, like the northern spotted owl, for example. There's no one single logging project that's going to affect the whole of its critical habitat, which is more than 9 million acres. So it allows for this death by a thousand cut scenario.
Is this a done deal, or does this need to go through Congress?
This is a done deal. We're going to challenge it in court for sure, but it does not need congressional approval. I mean, these are executive branch. The Trump administration can put rules in place that implement laws that were passed by Congress. And so that's what they've done here. And our only recourse is to go to court. There's a lot of procedural problems with the way these rules were put in place. For one thing, they went through a lot of changes. They got worse between the proposed rule and the final rule. So the American public hasn't had a chance to comment on the rules as they stand, as well as, you know, they did a categorical exclusion under the National Environmental Policy Act. They didn't actually evaluate the impact of these rule changes on the environment. We're hopeful that we'll be able to get a court to stop these rules from going into place.
What do you think their reasoning behind this is?
I mean, I think this is just a handout to their campaign contributors in industry. This doesn't benefit endangered species. It doesn't benefit the American people. It only, who, you know, by the way, broadly support protection of endangered species and recognize the importance of preventing extinction. This just benefits, you know, their buddies in the oil and gas industry or the big agriculture or other industries that see, you know, protections for endangered species as threatening short-term profits.
Well, I would imagine this is extra concerning given the situation with this mass extinction the planet's already seeing, and of course the dangers of climate change, which this administration doesn't seem to believe is a problem, which obviously goes against science and most of the world. Given all these impacts already happening to endangered species and now pulling away protections that are in place, how worried are you that even with a fight, if this starts happening, we could really lose a lot of species even more quickly?
Oh, absolutely. These rules will lead to extinction of species. And you're absolutely right. It comes at a time when, you know, just a month ago, the UN in a major report warned that more than a million species are at risk of extinction, many in the near near future. And climate change is looming, and it's, you know, one of the main impacts of climate change will be, you know, accelerated species extinction. You know, in the same way that Trump administration is just a disaster for the climate crisis, the Trump administration is an absolute disaster for the extinction crisis as well.
All right, that's Noah Greenwald, Endangered Species Director with the Center for Biological Diversity. Here are some of the stories you can find at voanews.com. A key U.S. lawmaker is warning China on its treatment of Hong Kong protesters. Turmoil seems to be calm as Puerto Rico's governor now, or its new governor, turns to policy. The death toll is nearing 200 in flood-stricken India. And Trump says he will reciprocate if countries issue U.S. travel warnings. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, it's been a year since an Ebola outbreak started the Democratic Republic of Congo's eastern region. And since then, 2,500 cases have been reported and more than 1,800 people have died. And now local faith leaders are taking the fight against the deadly virus into churches and other religious institutions. VOA's Austere Malivika reports.
Dr. Jean-Jacques Muyembe is leading the government's fight against Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He has enlisted the country's religious leaders in combating the deadly virus.
Yes, I think it is very important to go and to meet with pastors, with the priests in the churches, because in our country, in African communities, the pastor is very important, because most of our people will go and see the pastor if people has problem or if people are sick.
Religious leaders have been asked to halt their practice of laying hands on the sick, and they're urging their congregations to embrace protective health measures, avoiding hugs or substituting elbow bumps for handshakes during the sign of peace. They say prayers alone won't prevent or heal the disease.
It is time we all rise up and support the fight against Ebola. We must work together with the government. If we work together with the help of our partners, we can finish Ebola in 3 months, even in 1 month.
The DRC's 10th Ebola outbreak was declared last August. Since then, more than 2,500 cases have been reported, with 1,800 deaths. But the message coming from the pulpit is that Ebola is not a death sentence.
Ebola. If you are found to have been infected with Ebola in early stages, you can survive death. There are people who have been cured of Ebola.
Meanwhile, Congo's health ministry, partnering with the World Health Organization, has embarked on a vaccination program. Currently, the only people authorized to receive the vaccine are health workers and people who might have come in contact with other victims.
We don't have permission to vaccinate everyone. We are only vaccinating health officials and suspected people who came in contact with victims.
At least 2 people have died in Goma, a city of 2 million, raising fears the illness could spread quickly. Officials hope that preaching the gospel of good health can slow the advance of the deadly disease. For Auster Malivika in Goma, DRC, I'm Aida Issa, VOA News.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices. Her lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, audiences helped the Fast and Furious spinoff Hobbs and Shaw take another lap at number one, even with an onslaught of four new major film releases this weekend. Joining us to talk more about that film and one other that's new at the box office that didn't do quite as well, Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard joins us now. Jeff, let's start with The Rock's new Fast and Furious spinoff. Obviously, this is an action film.
This is a spinoff of the incredible, successful Fast and Furious franchise. And it also stars Jason Statham. And the previous Fast and Furious, they were at each other's throats. They were competing people, agents to save the world. The Rock had his own style. Jason Statham had his own style. Hobbs and Shaw. And people noticed, audiences noticed right away this incredible chemistry these two guys had. And of course, you heard about all the stories from the set of Fast and Furious between Vin Diesel and The Rock, how they did not get along. So now Universal says, look, we're going to do a spinoff series of Hobbs and Shaw. And they have to work together. Even though they're trading barbs and they're fighting each other and they're trading insults to the whole film, they realize they have to work together to save the world. And Idris Elba plays Brixton, who's this cyborg advanced soldier who's out to steal this virus to conquer the world. I know, simplistic plot. So we've got our car chases through the streets of London. We've got the action sequences on the sides of buildings and planes. And but what's really cool about this is The Rock infuses the movie with his heritage, his Samoan heritage. And what it means by that is the final act of the film, they do a massive battle with classically trained weapons that were used back for centuries in Samoan culture. So not only does The Rock deliver his incredible action for his fans and for audiences this summer, but also he gets to bring his heritage front and center for all his fans. So it is what it is. Yes, it's mindless, over-the-top action, but I'm telling you, the fans of The Rock and Jason Statham are going to love this end-of-the-summer blockbuster action film.
Wow, okay, that sounds great. What about The Kitchen? That's another one.
The Kitchen is based on a famous graphic novel from DC Comics about three Irish women whose husbands are Irish mobsters in Hell's Kitchen, New York in the late 1970s. They're sent to prison by the FBI, and of course the rest of the family and the neighborhood, the organized crime, they don't take care of them. They don't know where their rent is coming from. They don't know where their food is coming from. They've got families. So they say to themselves, they have this great idea, we're going to take over the business in Hell's Kitchen. We're going to run the neighborhood, but we're going to do it not only give protection to our customers, but we're also going to take care of the community. And so they have to deal with the Italians in Brooklyn. So it's got Melissa McCarthy and Tiffany Haddish, who are these Irish mobsters now who have to go door to door to survive. It's really a unique kind of situation with the comic book being adapted to a film. Unfortunately, Melissa McCarthy, even though she's great at dramatic roles, the movie never really takes off. It just seems like a parody of a gangster film that isn't done very well. And even though I adore her, and Tiffany Haddish too is not in a comedic role here, she's playing, you know, a mobster. The movie does have some extreme violence, but it just never seems to take off. It just becomes one big cliche. So The Kitchen, I wouldn't go there.
All right, we'll stick to action this week. All right, Jeffrey K. Howard, you can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Joe Walsh will be joined by ZZ Top, Brad Paisley, Sheryl Crow, and Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit at his Vets AIDS Music Festival to benefit veterans. The award-winning musician announced Monday that tickets for the November 10th concert at the Toyota Center in Houston will go on sale Friday in its first 2 years. Net proceeds have allowed Vets AIDS to disperse nearly $1.2 million in grants. This year, they will go to Houston area organizations. In a statement, Walsh says, quote, all are welcome to celebrate the things that unite us as Americans, good friends, open hearts, and great music. Walsh's father died while stationed in Okinawa, Japan, when the musician was just 20 months old. He often offers free guitar lessons to wounded veterans at Walter Reed National Medical Center outside of Washington. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Pete Hundley. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In his keynote address on the final day of the second ministerial to advance religious freedom, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called the event the largest human rights ministerial ever held at the United States Department of State.
It proves that religious freedom matters to literally billions of people all around the world. It's all of our concern. It is everyone's concern.
Tony Perkins is chair of the bipartisan U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, a federal government body established by Congress to raise awareness of the importance of religious freedom and to make policy recommendations to the President and Secretary of State. He said the attendance and scope of the ministerial this year show the commitment of the United States to championing religious liberty.
And on this second gathering of international leaders, we see a growing interest among global leaders to acknowledge this fundamental human right of religious freedom.
Chairman Perkins said there have been tangible results from the decision by the Trump administration to make the promotion of religious liberty a top priority.
From the first meeting that took place last year, we saw advancements where we saw a growth of international religious freedom roundtables where people are discussing this globally. We saw countries like the UAE stepping up to want to host regional gatherings to focus on the advancement of religious freedom.
In addition, this year the ministerial issued 9 statements of concern signed by a variety of different countries. They include statements deploring religious persecution by China, Iran, Burma, and non-state actors, as well as the use of surveillance technologies to repress religious freedom or commit other violations of human rights. Another statement, highlighted by Chairman Perkins, includes a call on the international community to equip and challenge foreign governments to provide greater protection for houses of worship. Chairman Perkins noted that while some 80% of the world's population currently lives in places where religious freedom is under threat, he remains optimistic that more societies will see that when religious freedom is respected, other things fall into place, including economic and social stability. With the United States government so focused on the promotion of religious liberty around the world, Mr. Perkins said, there is hope that we can move the needle on this issue and see more people being able to exercise their God-given freedom of religion.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is the